I've never heard a person walk out of the stadium and say, wow, I wish that game would have included more waiting.
He is an endless source of baseball and hockey knowledge.
Jose Berrios, el lanzador de Puerto Rico en el Clásico Mundial de Béisbol.
Sean Morosi, every week with Wyman and Bob.
You're being serious with me right now?
It's a conversation we look forward to each and every week here with Wyman and Bob. We are live at Edgar's Cantina here at T-Mobile Park. And joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline, our buddy John Morosi. How are you, my friend?
Outstanding, guys. So glad that we're having a conversation from the ballpark today. I'm just returned to Michigan. I was at Fenway Park last night, so I've got some fresh observations of those Baltimore Orioles, who've got a great team right now. And I love, too, that I'm talking to you. You're right there at T-Mobile. I see the Mariner lineup has been posted. We could talk about that. So many great storylines right now.
Well, of course, it's all sunshine. And at least we're talking about this team coming off of a win. The road trip as a whole, John, was a bit of a disaster. But they were able to get that final win. Are you somebody that believes in momentum? With a day off between games, they get the final game there in Toronto, and we're all hoping, fingers crossed, maybe they can carry some of that good feeling into the series that starts tonight against the Cubs. Are you a believer in that?
In this context, I'll be honest, not really. In terms of any carryover, I do think that I was really intrigued by the back and forth a bit with Cal Raleigh and what he had said about John Schneider. There was a fiery end to that series in Toronto for the Mariners. And I do think that flight feels a lot differently if you find a way to win that last game than if you don't, especially it's in extra innings. They needed a win, I think, just to give a different feel to the entire initial part of the season. So if they turn it around, if they have a good series against the Cubs this weekend, from where I sit, it's not going to be because of the result necessarily for Wednesday's game, but more about just letting this team settle in. They have not hit well to begin the season. We all know that. You look at the batting averages and the OPS. They just haven't scored. They haven't hit. The situational hitting has not been there. It's been a slow start offensively. We've heard this before with this team. This is not the first time we've been down this road, as you well know. But to me, if they get out of it, if they get out of this early season offensive funk, the way I see it, it's just because they're better than what they've shown. They were better than what they showed last year early. They eventually got out of it and almost made the playoffs. They're a better team now than what the batting averages say. Crawford's not a 140 hitter. Julio's not a 196 hitter. Polanco was brought in as really the capstone of this entire offseason. Remember Jerry DePoto saying how Justin Hollander has tried for years to acquire him and bring in Jorge Polanco. He's batting 167. He's better than that. And I think by the time we get to the early days of May, hopefully it happens before then, those numbers will start to reflect more of the players of the guys that we're talking about.
Hey, JP, you brought up John Schneider, and I liked that, and I love that it was Cal. But also, I think Cal said something about how he has a beef with a lot of guys in Major League Baseball. What do you know the sort of background there?
It's an interesting question. Maybe that's John's bluntness when he's speaking about matchups and the way that things go on. Certainly, it's been a rotation that has, I think, been because of maybe the stuff of the pitchers or how competitive they are, whether it's Manoa in the past or others, maybe has rubbed some guys the wrong way. John is, I really appreciate John's candor as a manager. He's from New Jersey. He still has that Northeast bluntness to him, I think, sometimes when he's talking about players and about the game. I actually went back and watched the press conference in question, and I understand why Cal took it the way that he did, because it does feel like a bit of a slight against his ability that, hey, he's someone that you can pitch to when you execute properly. My read of it, from having been in a lot of managerial press conferences over the years, my read there was he was saying to his own pitchers, we got to be better. Yeah. If we execute, he's a guy that we can get out. That it's less of a criticism of Cal or demeaning what he can do, and more saying we internally have to be better about hitting our spots. So that's how I read it. I read it really both ways. That I don't think John intended it to be in any way a criticism of Cal Raleigh. And yet I also think that when you do express it that way and you've got someone with the quiet confidence of a Cal Raleigh, he's going to take the receipts on that one and keep it. And then when he hits a big home run the next year, he's going to remember that. And so that to me was what stood out. And I think it's a good reminder, I think, for all of us that work in sports and work in media, the players are paying attention, whether they're directly listening or someone is marking it for them on social media to come back to you and remember when they hit a big home run a year later. They're watching and they're listening, and it's a good reminder, I think, for everybody that's involved. And I think, too, the big picture point I'll make on it is I've always felt this way about us, those of us that are on the radio or on television. When people say how they feel, I very rarely criticize them for doing so, because it's fun to talk about. We want people to tell us what they're thinking, because it either A, is interesting, or B, allows us to understand the game in a different way. And I think what John Schneider said a year ago told us a lot about how he felt about his pitching staff and maybe his catching at the time. And the way that Cal responded to that tells us a lot about Cal Raleigh and how competitive he is. So
yeah,
I'm glad all this is out in the open.
Hey, as far as this team struggling and what's gone on with them, they've taken turns. It's been the defense, it's been the pitching, it's been the hitting. It's kind of a collective so far in terms of what's struggled at points early in the season, John. When that happens, how much of that do you put on the manager? Because that becomes something that, as you know, fans will immediately do. And Service doesn't have these guys motivated. He needs to do this, that, and the other. I'm thinking he's only got so many options. He can't hit, pitch, or field for him. He's only got so many players to move, shuffle around in the lineup. It's not like there's a superstar sitting on the bench that he's ignoring. So I'm curious, how much do you put on a manager in this situation? Do you put more on the actual hitting coach, the fielding coach, the pitching coach, or do you just put it, hey, you guys are getting paid a lot of money to play this game. This is on the players.
Well, it's a great question. A couple things. Number one, the Mariners have changed enough of their personnel on the hitting coach side over the last couple of years. Brant Brown there is the offensive coordinator. Jarrett DeHart obviously is a familiar name. Tommy Joseph, it wasn't that long ago that he was an active player. I mean, I think he has a good perspective and his career and his journey in the game. So for me, I think they've got the right voices there. Maybe there's just that bit of learning how to go to the right hitting coach at the right time. It's interesting. I was talking to a player recently, Spencer Torkelson, here in Detroit. And the Tigers also, which is a modern thing, have three hitting coaches too. And he talked about how he knows that he has to go to a certain hitting coach if it's more of a mechanical conversation versus more of a feel conversation or more of maybe the almost like a pep talk. He knows who to go to in the right circumstance. And I think that with a somewhat new group of three still in the last couple of years, and then still some players coming in. Garver is new. Polanco is new. There is enough new there that it may take some time to develop. And the other thing that I'll make this point, and I was just in Alex Cora's office last night at Fenway Park, and we were talking about this, and Alex said, reflecting on his own career and his own journey in the game, he said, it is so hard to hit right now. It is so hard to hit. He said he thinks about how challenging it was for him to hit in his career, which was not that long ago. And now with the spin, the velocity, the reasons why we're seeing pitchers break down, unfortunately, are the same reasons why the batting average is lower than it was 20 years ago across Major League Baseball. It is really hard to hit. Pitches, you got these sweepers and sliders at 90 miles an hour. We never saw that 15 years ago. And I just think that it's interesting. The conversation we're having right now, trust me, the here in Michigan with the Tigers, it's the same thing. Last night in Boston, same conversation we were having about the Red Sox. But for a few teams that are really going right now, this, unfortunately, is situation normal for a lot of people around Major League Baseball right now. So it is concerning, yes, alarming, No, I'm not alarmed by this with the Mariners, but I will say this. I'm a little bit concerned that this has been now the playbook for them for a couple years. Get off to a slow start. They knew that this has been an issue with them for a while, but it's still there. And it's not a criticism. It's just acknowledging what we're seeing, which is, darn it, if they miss the playoffs again by a game or two, it's potentially going to be because of games they've lost in April. And this is biting them yet again.
Well, what's your concern? You know, you're talking about spin rate and velo and everything of as far as the injuries go. I mean, the other day I'm watching the show and, you know, you see Shane Bieber, Yuri Perez, Shane McClanahan, Alcantara, also Jacob DeGrom and Garrett Cole were shut down till August or June. But the first four I mentioned there, they're out for the season.
Right.
You know what? And, you know, look, it's because of those two things, right? I mean, they're putting their arms in weird positions, and I know some people were trying to say, JP, that it was because of the pitch clock, but, you know, it seems like it's just inevitable that if you have, and we have hard-throwing pitchers on this team, what's your level of concern as far as those injuries go right now with the pitchers?
Well, the concern is high because this is something that I think is really worth getting concerned about because of where we're at as an industry, and you're right.
Yeah.
A couple things about it. Number one, the spin is, as I see it, the main reason why. If you understand how to throw a slider or a sweeper, and if you think about it, you're rotating the ball somewhat parallel to the ground. If that makes sense, you're trying to sweep the ball across the strike zone with your arm. And if you're just like, if you can pantomime that in front of you right now, just feel what it does to your elbow ligaments when you do that. When you snap it off like that, it puts a lot of torque on it. Now imagine
Dave to do that. He's going to hurt himself.
Okay. I'm doing it right now, JP.
Here comes injury.
But
here comes
the sweeper. Not if you're driving. Not if you're driving. Just be safe, everybody.
Yeah.
But next time you have a chance to do it and you wonder what we're talking about, take your thumb and feel that your elbow joint, basically, as you do that, as your forearm tenses up when you make that motion with your fingers and you're rolling the ball over laterally, okay, horizontally to get the ball sweeping. And just imagine doing that at 90 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And with basically people saying, wow, with all the power in the game, balls that are hit are dangerous because they're going to leave the yard. Okay, so if I'm going to avoid that, then I've got to miss the bat entirely. And how do I do that? With spin or max velo. And Justin Verlander, it was like a 4-minute video. He talked about some of the nuances there, and I think a lot of what he said was correct. That pitchers realize that the hitters are good, and if you're going to avoid the bats and avoid the damage, you got to spin it or you got to throw it so hard that they just can't catch up to it. And both of those things are difficult for the human body to do repeatedly.
Yeah.
And you're asking people, and Verlander was a master at this when he was in his prime, which I saw up close. He would start games throwing 92, 93, and then by the end he could throw 97 or 98. It was unbelievable. Nobody else did this. But look at how long he's endured. Yeah, he missed time with a surgery, but it was one, and he's still going at the age that he's at right now. That, to me, is the art of pitching as opposed to throwing. And there's just been, it's no one person's fault, but the culture around it is broken. And I said this, and people, it's interesting, some of the reactions I was getting on X when I posted this, it was a mix. Some people said that I was right. Some people said that they disagree with the premise of what I said. But I go back to the 1990s Braves and Maddox, Glavin, Smoltz. We look at those three as being the greatest era of pitching with that group of three in our lifetimes, probably, for a sustained period of time. And if they were all amateur players right now, I'm not sure what their professional careers would look like, or even if they would have a professional career. Greg Maddux never threw 99, okay? And he's not 6'5". He's a shorter, by the standards of professional athletes, he's a shorter statured right-handed pitcher, which is almost always a red flag for guys. Oh, you can't have a righty unless it's Tim Hudson or a handful of guys. that scares scouts, okay? Smoltz was a basketball player from Michigan, and Glavin was a hockey player from Massachusetts. Multi-sport athletes in this showcase world, it's hard to do it. It's hard to be regarded as one of the top guys if you're playing a second sport or a third sport. And John did that here in Michigan, and Tom did that in Massachusetts. Tom Glavin was drafted ahead of two guys, Luke Robitaille and Brett Hull, who made the NHL Hall of Fame. Okay? That's how good of a hockey player he was. But that story doesn't exist. And so the system doesn't work. It's like we've taken our American pursuit of the greatest and the fastest and the extreme. This is the sports manifestation of it. So I am concerned about it. And what it means for teams, I don't think it's the pitch timer. This has been going on since long before the pitch timer came in last year. I think that's just not, that argument does not really move me. But totally what agree. I do think is this. If you think, and this is where the Mariners come into this conversation, if you think you're at the advent and the dawn of this amazing era of competitiveness over 3 or 4 or 5 years, I think that type of thinking is flawed. Ask the Miami Marlins. Look at the rotation that got them to the postseason for much of last year, and ask yourself how many of those guys are hurt right now. And that's an extreme case, but that used to be, oh my gosh, we're just coming into our own with our pitching. We're going to be great for the next 5 years. There's no need to trade this prospect to bring in a bat to go for it now because we're just starting. Nuh-uh. Nope. That argument right now is completely zero for me because you can't assume anything. If you're the Kansas City Royals right now, you're all of a sudden, you're hitting and your pitching is good, they better go for the World Series now. Because I'm not trying to say that there's like no tomorrow, but the history of the game right now is telling us that you can't count on anybody being healthy next year. So I'm not saying to be reckless, but if you've got a good team, the era of being methodical and super careful with your prospects, for me, I think is over. You've got to realize what's going on here. When you've got good pitching, you better maximize what you've got because you do not know how long that's going to last.
John, I got to get your take on the whole Shohei Ohtani saga, which continues. 37-page report from the feds there detailing every text over years and calls and wire transfers and everything. And I mean, the levels his interpreter was going to and seeing those text messages of what sounds like a stereotypical gambler who's like, just one more day. Well, another bump, man, just another bump. I won't ask again. Then they show the date and it's like 2 days later. All right, man, this is the last time I'm asking, I swear. And, you know, just reading all of that was kind of surreal, like watching a movie. But it feels like I know there's always conspiracy theorists out there that regardless of facts being presented to them in front of their face, they have a belief and they're not going to stray from that belief that this guy somehow is going to risk 30 years in prison to cover for Ohtani, and that'll be true in their mind, and that's fine. But what is your takeaway now that all these details are out there?
I think that the federal government and what was said yesterday in the indictment and in the statement there is very clear. I mean, the investigators said in very, very objective and clear language that all of the information that they've got indicates that Ohtani was a victim here. And the text messages that you allude to support that. All the information that we've got, I think from a baseball standpoint, if we're looking at it from a baseball lens, what the government has said, the federal investigators have said, is that their information says that Ohtani is a victim and that even within the wagers that were being placed by Ipe Mizuhara, that there was no evidence that baseball was involved. And so when you look at that information set, it does appear that again, Ohtani was a victim here and that there would be no further discipline from anybody, at that matter, for him, for Shohei. And I think so that's the baseball headline. The Ipe headline is, you know, sadly we're at the start of the criminal proceedings of it, and it's and you're right about the language that you read in the texts. Clearly, this is the language of addiction, and this is what he was addicted to. It's a sad story. It's a cautionary tale, I think, for for athletes and for the representatives and for teams about who you trust, checks and balances that need to be put in place, best practices that should be talked about. This is where you think about the big picture of a player's financial well-being. And obviously, in this case, Ohtani is really just at the outset of this record-setting contract, and I'm quite sure he's going to be okay. But not every athlete who is taken advantage of ends up being okay. And I think it's important for us to reflect on that as a society. And again, this is a, it's also, there are lessons in this for everybody in terms of finances and just a lot of different layers of the story. But I think now it is, this week to me feels like the point in which this is less of a baseball story and more of obviously a question of jurisprudence and what a trial or a plea agreement would bring, depending on what direction things go. And it just becomes a really profound cautionary tale for Shohei and other athletes, especially those that have this great stature around the world. It's just, it's a very sobering moment of who you can and should trust and the checks and balances that need to be there.
John, as always, fantastic stuff. We appreciate you. Have a great weekend and look forward to talking next week.
You got it, guys. Cubs, Mariners, we can call that the Lou Piniella series, my friends. Two of the great teams that he managed. So enjoy. Think of Lou this weekend, and it should be a good matchup.
Good there stuff. Have a good weekend, John.
Thanks, JP.
You as well. Thank you so much.
There you go. John Morosi with us each and every week. If you missed any of that conversation, it will be available on the podcast page after the show at seattlesports.com. And a reminder, don't miss out on one of the best giveaways of the season, the Ken Griffey Jr. Home Run Robbery Bobblehead. It's a three-day giveaway, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday when the Reds are in town. First 10,000 fans each game scoring a legendary Griffey collectible. You can also get Mariners value game tickets to all three games starting at $10. How about that for all three games? So just go to mariners.com/value games. All right, coming up, we're going to take a look at another position group that should be of interest early in the draft for the Seattle Seahawks team. We'll get into that next as we continue live from Edgar's Cantina at T-Mobile Park. It's Wyman and Bob, Seattle Sports on 710.
Wyman and Bob,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio
on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
Our thanks to John Morosi, who joined us in the previous segment. If you guys are just tuning in, that conversation will be on the podcast page after the show at seattlesports.com. Just click the podcast tab, click on our picture, and it's right there waiting for you. And click subscribe. That's the key to all of it. Make sure you do that. A reminder to come out to T-Mobile Park for Salute to Armed Forces Night presented by Boeing. That's tomorrow at 6:40. The Mariners will have special pregame and in-game programming in honor of our nation's service members, plus the first 10,000 fans will have the chance to grab a Salute to Armed Forces Mariners cap, which if you're watching on the stream, we have a couple on the desk here that are being held down by the Ken Griffey Jr. bobblehead because the wind is blowing pretty hard here. But you can get a look at what those are. You can get your tickets at mariners.com. So that is coming up, and a reminder about all the giveaways. They got the hoodie, I think, giveaway tonight is what this is, right? This is tonight, isn't it, Lefko?
Yeah, put it on. I heard you wanted to model it, right?
No, I think we'll give it away to somebody, leave it in the pack. But
that is tonight, yes.
Yeah, here's tonight's giveaway for those of you on the stream. And there are the hats, and there's the bobblehead. We got a little bit of everything here.
We got the Kingdom there.
Oh, yeah.
Mariner
yeah.
logo. We got a baseball. There we go.
There
beautiful.
You go.
Looks like pajamas, kind of.
It kind of does. A little bit. And a reminder before we get into some of these edge rushers in the draft that we do have Mean Techs coming up at 5:15 today. So you got time. How have they been doing, Lefko? Do they need inspiration?
They need inspiration.
They do?
Yeah. Morons. They're not good. Yeah.
You heard Wyman there. Said, you're morons. I think you're all brilliant and creative, and I'm just being patient. But these guys are impatient, and they think you're dumb. So I don't.
That's not going to get you anywhere, Bob. I'm sorry.
They're not going to have any mercy on me for that. 866-979-3776, powered by Mac and Jack's Brewing Company, is where you send your mean text, and we'll do that at 5:15. So yesterday we took a look at the top 10, according to that article that I sent you, top 10 linebackers that are available in the draft. They did it for each position group. Now we've got edge rushers out there and a couple that you've had a chance, Dave, to take a look at and break down. Let's start with a kid out of Alabama, Dallas Turner.
Yeah, this one's interesting just because he has sort of risen into everybody's top 10 all of a sudden. And I remember early on we were talking, we'll get to Jared Verse next. He's a Florida State kid, but he was the only defensive end that really people were putting in the...
I saw him attached to the Seahawks in a couple of mocks early.
Yeah, and we'll get to him. But Dallas Turner, you know, here's the one thing I think he has. First of all, he ran a 4.46 40 at the combine, and he had a 40.5-inch vertical.
And he's 6'3", 250.
Yeah. I mean, he is a big dude, and he's just incredibly explosive. But the thing that really stood out to me about him, well, first of all, a lot of these guys, you'll see that they haven't played in very many college games. You know, they're turning pro early and, you know, entering into the draft. But for him, he's had a good career. He has 38 games at Alabama. And then, you know, at Alabama, you know, they're getting coached up like, it's basically playing on a pro team. 22 and a half career sacks. The one thing I saw about him that was very interesting to me was that the way he moves around the field, as far as his sense for angles, it's kind of like when you talk about, you know, a guy in the outfield, left fielder, he just takes the minimum number of steps to get there. And that's what he looks like. Like a lot of times I'll say, you know, the guy really comes tight on like stunts and things like that. It's just, I don't know how to explain it. It's natural for him. It's just the way that he moves around the field. So, yeah, and I don't, you know, top 10, I'm not sure if that's the case, but I was looking at Ryan Wilson, our guy from CBS, who, you know, grades him, and he had him going at number 6, I think. So, yeah, really interesting player.
Well, and the name we just brought up, and again, a name that was in some of the early mocks we were looking at, I saw his name at 16 for the Seahawks, and I've seen him being taken higher, lower, we'll all find out. But Jared Verse out of Florida State, 6'4", 255.
Yeah, and he is incredibly explosive. And I think you'll like this, Bob. He got 31 reps on the 225 bench. 31. And that's the thing about him. He is just incredibly powerful. And, you know, 6'4", 250, as you mentioned. But the one thing that kind of stood out a little bit, he's kind of mechanical. And we'll get, I saved the best for last. We'll get to the UCLA edge rusher. But he's a little bit more mechanical, but he's more powerful. And he's just,
so you know. When you say mechanical, what do you, are you talking
not,
like
he's Uchenna? Not fluid. Huh?
You talked about Uchenna, who doesn't really have a move per se, that he's just
that would be
kind of a bull rush, or is that kind of similar or not?
Yeah, I would say that's you know what you get from Uchenna. He's not super fluid, and you know, and especially compared to the next guy. But yeah, he's very powerful, and I think he's just kind of, I don't want to say he's a one trick pony, because he does have some pass rush moves. They're just not very smooth. But what he does have is, I mean, I saw him just dump a 325-pound tackle on his butt and just run right over him and get to the quarterback. So, yeah, he's I think that's his game. And like I said, he works hard. 31 reps, man. I think at the end of my rookie year, I got 30. But when I went to the combine, I think I had like 23 or 24 reps. That is, he works hard.
Plus, you figure at 6'4", his arms have to be pretty long.
Yeah,
I would assume. Exactly. So he's at a bit of a disadvantage there. But yeah, 31, my goodness.
Yeah.
And then this, you saved the best for last?
Yes, sir.
Is this the guy you think of this group as the best?
I do. Leiatu Latu, UCLA, 6'5", 255 pounds. He was a unanimous All-American, 13 sacks his senior year, and then 2 interceptions. And I was kind of referring to him.
You wrote, he's a ghost.
Yes,
what does
man.
That mean?
He just disappears. Like, his hands are so good and his feet that you see blockers will just like all of a sudden lunge forward and there's nothing there. Like, he's around him. He's just so good that way. And guys, really, he won the Lombardi Award, which is for on and off the field as far as discipline and character and things like that. But man, he just, I think one of the other things, he's so quick that he kind of makes the offensive lineman's target disappear. You know, like he's, and I think it was Coach Gibbs that we used to say, aim small, miss small, or something like that. Or maybe that was our guy, offensive line coach here, Tom Cable. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it looks like these guys are trying to get like a target on him, and then they just miss him because he's so fluid. He gets around them, and he's got a great, definitely a great swim move, but he's also pretty powerful. The other thing is they dropped him back into coverage a few times. He got two interceptions, and actually in both of those, I feel for the kid because on one he got tackled at like the half yard line and the other one was at like the 6 yard line. I'm like, you're like 7 yards away from
two touchdowns.
Six. Yeah.
Now, but he's the class of the bunch in your opinion?
In my opinion, yeah. I think he's the best pass rusher out of anybody that I've looked at in the first couple of rounds. So, yeah, just incredibly talented and just has a knack for it. You know, and I'm sure he was well coached and all that, but
we've talked about Seahawks have 7 picks to work with as we sit. Now, they may accumulate more with some moves, but just assume they have those 7. And yesterday we were like, well, they got to take a linebacker, at least one, with one of those picks. We don't know which one, but one of the 7 will be a linebacker. Do you feel like one of them will be an edge rusher if they were to stick at 7?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're going to take the best player. I mean, the more we talk to John, I would not be surprised if he took Penix. I mean, after everything that we went through, you know, with Geno and then, you know, the trade for Howell and all that, it's just it would be on point for John Schneider, right?
It'd be pretty exciting.
Yeah. And like this, I mean, last year they didn't need corners and they took Devin Witherspoon. It was fantastic. They've taken
linebackers when they didn't need linebackers. They took a running back when we didn't feel like they needed a running back. So,
well, and we're pretty set on edge rushers, right? If you get Uchenna and then you got Boye Mafe and then
Daryl Taylor's back.
If we, you know, see what we get out of him. And then Hall also, the guy that Derek was just drafted last year. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like you're pretty set there, but I wouldn't. I mean, if this guy, especially if you could get Latu, I really like him. I think he's a really good player.
All right, there you go. Look at some of the potential candidates for your Seattle Seahawks, depending on where these guys fall. Draft just a couple of weeks away, and we'll be out there live from the Virginia Mason Athletic Center taking you wall to wall on the draft. So definitely want to stay tuned for all of that. Meanwhile, we had to bring back one back from last week because it sounds even worse now. Wyman coming your way next, live from Edgar's Cantina at T-Mobile Park. It's Wyman and Bob, Seattle Sports on 710.
Tell me why. Why, man? Why?
Lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
He's a habitual line stepper.
What were you thinking? What are you doing?
Why are you the way that you are?
It's the Wyman of the Week.
Wyman is presented by Mazda of Everett. As we continue live from Edgar's Cantina at T-Mobile Park, it's Wyman and Bob and a couple of good candidates here. Now, this one we played before, and this was early in the Shohei Ohtani story being brought out publicly, and Mike Greenberg had some very definitive opinions on how this was being received and what he would have done in Ohtani's shoes. And well, let's reflect. Here's what he had to say.
His story makes no sense. Nothing is less believable than the version of events that Team Ohtani is trying to present here. If we are to believe the version of events that Shohei Ohtani is now offering us, he found out, to his great shock, that his longtime best friend had stolen $4.5 million from him and wire transferred it $500,000 at a time with no one's knowledge, which is ludicrous. Let's even live in a world where that could happen, which it can't. What's the first thing you do? You contact law enforcement, right? You bring in the authorities. Whoever it is, one calls. I don't know. I've never had $4.5 million stolen from me, but if I did, I would definitely call someone. But when they ask Shohei Ohtani, well, who have you contacted about this? The answer is they refuse to talk about it. They will not tell you who they've contacted. And the reason is they never contacted anybody because this isn't what happened here.
Wow. Good show, Mike. Attaboy. Have we heard a follow-up from him? Because
I think it
even then, the part that stuck out to me was, who'd he contact? I'd contact somebody. He's like, Mike, he was contacted by the authorities. He was the one. They informed him, at which point there would be redundancy if he turned around and said, well, thank you, FBI, Department of Justice. I'm gonna turn around and give you guys a call back and let you know that what you just told me is going on.
Well, I'll tell you what, at the very worst, he's really dumb, right? I mean, if he's not paying attention to that kind of money and those kinds of transactions,
But as we learned in the details, it wasn't 500 every time he did it. They're saying this guy was, you know, a little bit here, big one here, small one here.
Yeah, the bats.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what about the transfers?
Yeah, but some were large, but not every one of them was $500,000 a day. And how do you not notice? That makes it sound horrible, which is inaccurate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, still, it just, like I said, at the worst, he's terribly either naive or just dumb and with his money.
Way too trusting.
Not paying attention. Yeah, and too trusting. So, yeah, I'm curious. It's a very interesting story, but it seems like it's sort of, do people really care? I mean, it's kind of a, did anybody really get hurt? I mean, yeah, he got, if it's true, $16.5 million stolen from him. So,
yeah.
But, you know, what would that be like us losing $2,000,
$20, $50?
I mean, I don't know that anybody's going to get too, you know, up in arms over it because, you know, I mean, the gambling part kind of tarnishes your reputation a little bit, but yeah, I don't know. And if it was him, then he has a really strong, powerful addiction. And if that were present, I feel like you would be able to see it in his play. Like he would have, it would have affected him. And, yeah. And he's been pretty good.
Yeah, he's been very good. Yeah, and if anything, you could accuse him of being extremely naive and way too trusting.
Yeah.
In that, but the idea of a man of his financial wherewithal entrusting his finances to somebody else is the least unique element of this story. You know, I've told you about my uncle who's way up in the entertainment industry, and they've got some of the biggest stars in the world. He's talked to me a million times about these guys have no idea what they have in the bank. They have financial advisors. They got money managers. They don't even pay their own bills. They have no idea what they're being charged for their mortgage payment, much less their car payment and anything else. They give full access to these people.
Yeah, which is really, you know, not very smart. Like I used to manage money for people. And, you know, I had this guy who had he had like $1 million in cash. And, you know, just sitting there in a cash account. And his guy was charging him 1%. So that's $10,000. And I was like, you can open a cash account here at Merrill Lynch for $250.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. So, I mean, paying attention to those kinds of things is, you know, there are people that are getting fat off of this. And it's just something that you've got to have a minimal amount of attention that you pay to that, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. They were talking in that report from the DOJ that apparently his interpreter, you know, they had a bank account that he was specifically running the finances, and anybody that asked him about it, he said, no, Shohei wants to keep this private. This isn't, you're talking to their money managers and all the people that generally work with him, and even the people at his management company. He was the interpreter, so nobody there spoke Japanese except for this guy.
Yeah.
And who knows what they were saying versus what he was telling Shohei, and Shohei had no idea, obviously, what he's saying to them.
I wonder if that'll make him want to, you know, definitely brush up on his English and, you know, get a little bit more independent that way.
I would hope he learns a lesson from this, that at minimum I'm going to, all right, I need to know exactly what I've got financially that I'm working with here, and I want to be kept up to date on what's coming in and what's going out.
Yeah.
I want details here. But, all right, number two comes courtesy of Tom Brady, who we thought was retired. I thought he was just going to ride off into the broadcast booth and be the superstar at Fox, but says he was on the Deep Cut with Vic Blenz podcast. Never heard of that one, but says he still wants to play if a team calls him at some point during the season.
One day there's a situation, right? Maybe it's the 49ers, maybe, you know, heading to the playoffs, offense is great.
Patriots, somebody, Raiders, look, could be, you never know.
God forbid somebody goes down, would you pick up that phone?
I'm not opposed to it. If they would, I don't know if they're gonna let me if I become an owner in the NFL team, but I don't know if, I'm always gonna be in good shape, always be able to throw the ball, so. To come in for a little bit, like MJ coming back. I don't know if they let me, but I wouldn't be opposed to it.
I golfed one time. This is Tom Brady. I'm not comparing myself to Tom Brady, okay? Let's just make clear that very clear.
Unless right you're now. Throwing snowballs.
Yeah. Or rocks. But I remember one time I was out of the league for like 5 years. I think I was like 36, 37. And I had this buddy I was golfing with, and he's like, I know Coach Holmgren. I know Mike Holmgren really well. And I was like, I was in really good shape still. And I was like, hey, ask him if, you know, maybe I can get a tryout or walk on. I'm 37. Yeah. I've been out of the league for 5 years. And I was serious about it. Like, I really was. And he comes back, and I go, did you talk to Holmgren? He goes, yeah. He said, he would love to have you if you weren't so old. And I was just crushed because, you know,
said,
I was
so what is he saying?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I don't know. I think every player kind of dreams, like, hey, I think I still got it, you know.
And oh,
I,
yeah.
You know, Brady, I don't know if we saw declining skills necessarily. That's one of the quarterback is one of the positions where you get better.
Yeah, the older certainly you are. Smarter, and yeah, he didn't take a beating in his career, so right. Maybe he could. I don't know. Usually those are fighters that do that, boxers.
That don't
know when to say no. They think, I still got it. I'm in great shape. They go out there, and the chin's not there anymore, and they just take a beating.
Yeah.
You saw it with Ali. You see it with every great. It's just, generally it's in that sport.
And but then, I think it just indicates just a total passion and love for the sport, right?
Yeah, and ultimate belief in yourself.
Right.
So there you go. There's another Aaron Rodgers conspiracy theory out there. We don't have time for it, but he's putting on a show once again. So check that out if you've got time. Meanwhile, how different will this Seahawks offense look this upcoming season? We're going to get into that next as we continue live from Edgar's Cantina here at T-Mobile Park. It's Wyman and Bob. This is Seattle Sports on 710.